ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This August, Science Week is blooming around the ABC.
This Science Week, we're celebrating Australia's wildflowers.
Get involved. Vote now in the search for Australia's favourite wildflower
at abc.net.au/science. Celebrate Science Week with us in August on ABC Radio National
and at abc.net.au/science.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Local councils have found themselves on the front line of homelessness over the past few years as people with nowhere to go set up camp in public parks. One council, which had previously come under fire for breaching human rights, has done a total U-turn. They're designating one park as a safe place for homeless folks to set up camp, providing some services and, importantly, removing the threat of punitive action. Should more councils do the same? Also ahead, ever since the Duolingo owl became a TikTok sensation, it seems like every organisation from corporate brands to your state police department wants to be hip and sassy. Does it actually generate sales? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, it's not too long ago that to pay for something you had to hand over cash, or at least a card. But last year, 40% of payments were coming not from your physical wallet, but from a device like your phone or a smartwatch. Well, one company is looking to take this a step further and have introduced a payment terminal that allows you to pay not with a device, but with your face. They're calling it Paying with a Smile. It's a while off being super commonplace in Australia. It would be an opt-in service, but it's got me feeling some kind of way. My phone already recognises my face to allow me to pay with a tap, but for some reason, this maybe feels more invasive somehow. To be fair, no one is forcing us to use these things, but tech does have a way of evolving so fast that you don't always get time to consider the implications of what you're saying yes to. And before you know it, you're smiling away, paying with your face for your groceries, for beers at the pub. Well, you are about to hear from two people who've been thinking about the implications of this deeply, but tell me, how do you draw boundaries around your own digital privacy? Is there a tech that you refuse to use or maybe used to refuse to use, but it's crept into your life anyway? Here with me is Lauren Perry. She's the Responsible Technology Policy Specialist at the University of Technology, Sydney. Lauren, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks for having me.
Like, knee-jerk reaction, paying with your face. What's your initial, how you feel about this?
Yeah, so whenever I hear about new commercial uses of facial recognition technology, the first questions that come to mind for me are, what is the issue that these companies and these technologies are trying to solve? Is it actually a problem? And is facial recognition really the right solution? So, you know, in particular with this example with, you know, paying with your face, I sort of think, look, I tap my card or I tap my phone and actually that's really, really quick. That is quite convenient. That is a good technological, you know, evolution of payments. But once you add that face element, there's a whole lot of reasons why that can go wrong in the moment. You know, there's people have glasses, people's faces change. Sometimes the lighting is not so good in stores. Like, I actually feel like there's going to be more problems created than it solves.
Okay, that's an interesting point that the tech might not work at all. Let's say it works perfectly, though. That raises a whole other set of concerns. Can you talk to me about biometric data, how it actually is encoded, how it actually works?
Yes, so biometric data refers to physical or behavioural characteristics that are uniquely yours. So including the features of your face, your fingerprints, your voice, even the way you walk, you know, or sign your signature. That's what we're referring to when we talk about biometric data. And under Australia's, you know, privacy laws, biometric data is classified as sensitive personal information, and it's, you know, subject to additional protections because it is so personal, and you can actually glean a lot of information about an individual from that data. So by having to, you know, if you wanted to opt in to use your face to start paying for things, that's a lot of sensitive personal information that's starting to be collected by private companies.
Why is it so sensitive? Like, I walk around with my face on display all the time. People can see it.
People can see it in the moment, but they're not capturing that template and then storing that and using it to, you know, for possible decision-making and implications later down the line. So I guess it differs from other data that's collected about us because it's more than just personal information. It's inherent to the very essence of who you are. And when a private company has that information on file, I mean, we just have to think about the many, many cyber incidents and mass data leaks that I'm sure many of your listeners, you know, have been caught up in over the last few years. People being caught up in identity fraud, that can be an absolute nightmare, having to update things like email addresses or license numbers and passwords. But the stakes can get so much higher when you introduce that sensitive biometric information. And it can create a lifelong cybersecurity vulnerability when that data is out there. You know, at the end of the day, you can change a password as many times as you need, but you can't change your face.
Yeah, so true. As much as we might like to wish that we could. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Lauren Perry from UTS about paying with a smile, a technology that looks like it's coming to Australia soon. I'm interested to know how you feel about this tech specifically, but also just kind of tech creep broadly. Is there a technology that you tried to hold off on adopting and kind of found yourself using it anyway? One person says, amazing time in history for evil twins. Iconic text. Thank you very much for that. Another said, my friend had her makeup done professionally. Facial recognition did not recognize her when she went to pay with her phone. Really great makeup artist by the sounds of it. Well, also here to talk about this is Kirsten Drysdale, independent journalist, host of The Internet Reviewed. Kirsten, you've got a great smile. Would you pay with it?
Hi, Tegan. I've got to say, I think this is one that I would balk at myself personally. I'm not a technophile, but I'm not a technophobe. I'm sort of like that middle of the road tech user. But this, I think I would draw a line at.
Why? What is it about it that makes you take a step back?
For me, it's that, you know, like you say, like your phone recognizes your face and you can pay with your watch and your own phone. But for me, I'm like, but that's my own device. That's my personal property. And this is asking me to let a business's device scan my face. And I just have questions about, you know, privacy, data security, who controls that data, who has access to that data. That's the kind of thing that I think. And I just feel like, is it necessary? It's very easy for me to just tap and pay at the moment. Do I need to take that step? But look, I do think there'll be a small but enthusiastic group of people who will adopt it immediately. The kinds who, you know, years ago, those kinds of people were already inserting the RFID chips under their skin to pay for things. I don't think that kind of person's going to have a problem.
Yeah, Kirsten, you're talking to people, you've been talking to people for years about how they sort of feel about products and the internet and that sort of thing. Do you have a sense of who's going to be an adopter of this and who's not?
Like I said, I think it's just going to be a small group of tech enthusiasts. But I think what's interesting to note is that the general public, like the overall view of the tech industry, is at a pretty much a record low at the moment. So for years, people kind of generally looked upon the tech industry favourably, but in the last sort of 5 or so years, we don't have such a fond view of big tech, and trust has fallen dramatically. So I just think that it won't be as big a group as it could have been even maybe 5 to 10 years ago.
It's interesting you say that about it, that trust being low, because uptake is still high. Lauren, can you talk me through some of the places where facial recognition technology is already being used?
Yeah, we're seeing a real proliferation of the technology around Australia. Just in the last few weeks, we've seen the Western Australian Police Force begin Australia's first ever trial of live facial recognition technology to try and essentially scan people in the crowd, people just on a walk on the street to find people who have outstanding arrest warrants and that kind of thing. We're seeing as well in the last few weeks a number of sporting venues looking at implementing the technology as an alternative to scanning a ticket at the gate. So instead, you could submit a selfie, rock up to the footy, have your face scanned, and then move through that way. And we've even seen uptake of the technology on an individual level. So there was a lot of talk in the last week about Meta glasses and the use of those technologies and the surveillance culture that kind of brings to an individual-to-individual level.
So one person's texted in, Lauren, saying you could be scammed just walking around smiling. Is that true? How powerful is this technology?
I mean, it really depends who is using it, what they're using it for, where that data is going. So again, going back to that Meta glasses example, at the moment, that technology or any kind of smart glasses has the ability to take photos and take videos of people. But the problem is, you know, up until now, you know, you've been able to use a smartphone to take videos in public, but there is that friction, I guess, where people recognize that a photo is being taken, people, you know, have their smartphone lifted up and people can get out of the way if they kind of feel a bit uncomfortable about being recorded in public. We're seeing now with the, you know, increase in the technology and the way that it's embedded into everyday elements of our lives through things like glasses, that a lot of people actually don't know that they're being filmed. Because it's a remote technology, that automatically creates that distance and that element that it's actually really hard to know as an individual when you are or aren't being surveilled.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Lauren Perry from UTS and Kirsten Drysdale, independent journalist host of The Internet Reviewed, about a new payment technology that allows you to pay with your face, facial recognition payment. And just you're telling me stories of what you're maybe trying to opt out of and just how difficult that becomes when technology keeps moving apace. John says, I won't use social media on ethical principles and also the vast information asymmetry. I also simply don't like the trend to live through my cell phone. Phone networks are a fragile thing by accident or by design, as regularly witnessed in more totalitarian countries. Kelly says, no biometrics for me. I had to sign in with a fingerprint at work years ago. There was no clarity about what happened to that data when I left the employer. My friend pays by cash only. I'm keen to go back to doing that. I'm not sure what I'm waiting for, but I really wonder what will be the ramifications of what I'm agreeing to. Kirsten, how hard is it for people to opt out of technology like this if they want to?
This is one of those things, like with all of these sorts of technological advances, I think once you reach a critical mass of people using it and it becomes the sort of social norm, it does start to become increasingly difficult to be one of those in the minority trying to, you know, saying no. Most people don't like to be a pain in the proverbial. Like, there's always a few who are very stubbornly principled about these things. But, I mean, cash payments are a great example of that. So digital payment is the norm now, and there are places out there that you can't pay with cash for, which isn't even meant to be allowed. But that's the way it goes once you just reach a critical mass of people. So these things, they're sort of thrust upon us, I feel. We have a choice in theory, but in the end, not in practice.
Yeah, Lauren, your job title is Responsible Technology Policy Specialist. If it sort of implies that the technology is here, we need to be responsible about how we regulate it. What kind of regulations do we need to safeguard folks?
Yeah, so, I mean, unfortunately, Australian privacy law is woefully out of date. It was created in the 1980s prior to our connection to the internet, let alone the proliferation of AI and digital technologies. So it's not really fit for purpose in our digital data-driven age. And as we've sort of been touching on just now as well, there's a bit of a weakness in our consent models for privacy law. So the way the law is currently set up, it really relies on individuals to be able to assert their own independence and push back on technologies rather than putting the onus back on organisations to handle our data safely and reasonably. So, I mean, there are some ways we can change this. And in fact, the government has committed to a range of improvements to tighten up Australia's Privacy Act. At this stage, they're still promises on paper. So it's really important that the government follows through on these commitments. But one of those commitments is to introduce a fair and reasonable provision, which essentially requires organisations collecting and using personal information to act fairly and reasonably, regardless of whether the individual consents to having their data collected.
Surely that should go without saying. Kirsten, what do you see as the future of this technology in Australia? Do you see it eventually being adopted the way paying with your phone or your watch has?
Look, I'm sceptical that it'll catch on in the same way as the phone and the watch. But then again, I do also see how easily persuaded we are by convenience and small treats. So I saw that one of the announcements for this technology to be used in, say, cafes and things is that it'll be a way to track your loyalty points. So, ultimately, is that enough of a carrot for us to give into this? A free coffee once a fortnight in return for scanning my face to pay. I personally feel like it won't be adopted the same way as the phone or the watch, but I might be wrong about that. Coffee is pretty pricey at the moment.
It's also a very, you have your coffee before your brain kicks in at the start of the day, so you're in a vulnerable position when you're ordering it. Lauren, if people are interested in protecting their privacy today, where should they start?
I think it's really a challenging question. Again, we talk about the fact that unfortunately the onus is often at the moment put on individuals to be really aware of what's happening. But actually, I think that people also need to remember that new technology is created and deployed by humans. It's not just something that comes down from above and that we have to reluctantly accept as the way of the future. And I think each and every one of us has the, ability or should have the ability to feel like they can push back when they encounter technologies that they feel uncomfortable with. And this sort of goes for all technology change, really. I was having conversations with my family over the weekend about how, my mum and my husband regularly still queue up to be served by a human at the grocery store to avoid that self-checkout machine, which just always assumes you're trying to do something dubious with unexpected items in the bagging area. And so I think the more we kind of speak with our feet and say, yeah, I am going to queue up for this human service, the more that, tech companies and retail suppliers and venues sort of realize, okay, we can't just make this 100% of the way, perhaps some people want to pay with their face. That's fine. We'll leave that as an option. But we also need to make sure there are alternative options for people who are uncomfortable.
Well, Lauren, Kirsten, thank you both so much for sharing your insights today. Lauren Perry, Responsible Technology Policy Specialist at the University of Technology, Sydney. Kirsten Drysdale, Independent Journalist, host of The Internet Reviewed. And thank you for sharing your ideas with me as well. Malcolm says, I couldn't believe it when people adopted Tap and Go. So insecure. If anyone found my card after I dropped it, they could tap and go all day. And now people want to give control of their face to a corporate entity? ! Ali says, I use cash as much as possible. There just has to be some breakdown in our systems and we won't be able to buy goods and services. Well, you are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, are you seeing more people sleeping rough in your local community? One Queensland council has designated a park for homeless people to camp legally. Is this a realistic solution? The city of Moreton Bay just north of Brisbane, has announced they'll turn a council park into a free legal campsite for people experiencing homelessness. They'll have access to toilets, running water, and barbecue facilities. And it is a sharp U-turn from moving homeless people on actions this very same council undertook before adopting this new approach. Recent research found 2/3 of Australian councils now consider homelessness a significant or acute issue in their local area. Because when residents see tents popping up where they like to walk their dog or where their kids play, they don't call their local MP or even the police. They call the local council, even though this layer of government is technically not responsible for this growing issue. So as this one council takes a new direction, should others follow? You're about to hear from a man who has experienced homelessness himself. He is now a university lecturer, but I'd love to know what's happening in your area. Is homelessness becoming more visible where you live? How is your community responding? With me is Dr. Gregory Smith, OAM. He's experienced homelessness. He's now a homelessness advocate and senior lecturer at Southern Cross University. Gregory, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you.
What do you think of City of Moreton Bay's new policy?
Well, as you mentioned, it's certainly a turnaround from their previous actions, and I think that's a direct result of the court rulings that came down from that. What do I think of it? I think it's a game. They're trying to do well, okay, but I don't think it's a good idea.
Okay.
What it speaks to me about is that they haven't really looked at a whole lot of options. This is a better response than the reaction they had last time. But having said that, people actually need permanent housing.
Right. So it's sort of a stopgap response. Is that what you mean?
Well, it's not just a stopgap response. It'll attract other people as well.
So okay.
It'll attract people that are coming close to housing vulnerability. And that's an increasing issue across Australia.
So when you say it'll attract people, do you mean that that's not a good thing?
That's up to the community to decide. Mm-hmm. Personally, I don't think it is. But I think it's really good. This is a little bit of a vexed situation. It's really good that the council has changed its approach. Allocating legal land for people to camp on free with services is going to attract more people. It won't take long before people from that Sunshine Coast, Northern Rivers hear about this, and then they go up there because it's safe.
I hear you.
So it's actually attracting more people. It's going to attract more issues for the council.
And so then the question here is whether other councils maybe consider doing the same. Just a bit of context, the City of Moreton Bay Council had come under fire and actually went to the Queensland Supreme Court, which ruled that the council had violated the human rights of homeless campers when it evicted them from public parks in 2025. This new designation of one park as a safe space for homeless folks or people experiencing homelessness is in response to that. You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. The voice you have been hearing is that of Gregory Smith, homelessness advocate, senior lecturer at Southern Cross University. Also here with us is Leanne Mitchell. She's with the Australian Alliance to End Homelessness. She's researched the role local councils play in addressing homelessness all over the world as part of a Churchill Fellowship. Leanne, welcome back to Life Matters.
Hey, Tegan. Great to be here.
So with what Gregory's saying about this policy potentially attracting people to Moreton Bay, how concerning is that for you?
That's often a concern for councils even when they start looking at responses to homelessness. And I mean, I suppose we have to take a step back and think about the need that people have, and it's an unmet need. So if more people do come to Moreton Bay, that's because there's more people who actually need housing and need support. So hopefully what we see out of this is a situation where the state government in particular, and the federal government too, because they have the money, actually see this and jump in and start doing, playing their role in supporting people who are really doing it very, very tough, because people who are rough sleeping are really the small but visible group of people experiencing homelessness.
Sure. So here's City of Moreton Bay Mayor Peter Flannery spoke to ABC Brisbane about how difficult this issue can be for councils. Here's a little bit of what he had to say then.
Council's hands are tied to a certain degree of what we can do in our public spaces. Our legal requirement is to keep our public spaces safe. We were trying to do that with moving people on in the past. We did learn from the court case that we shouldn't have been asking them to move to somewhere where there was nowhere else to go. So this is providing that somewhere else to go. So it's our way of being compassionate. If they can show respect for public space, they can get the support they need, and hopefully it's a safe place for them and safer for the broader community.
So, Leanne, you've previously worked for local government. Are we asking councils to take on a problem they don't actually have the resources to solve?
Yes, we absolutely are. And really, to paraphrase a mayor from Canada, Mike Savage from Halifax, he said in the Canadian situation that when it comes to housing and homelessness, the feds have the money, the provinces or the states have the responsibility, and the cities have the problem. And that's really what we sort of see having here over here too. I mean, councils, you know, when we think about the Australian homelessness response system, we basically look at housing and we look at specialist services. And the states and the federal governments really focus on those two areas. But what they forget, and because local government isn't included in that picture, what we forget is that local government actually has the role of looking after the public realm. And that's where homelessness happens. And what we find is that communities who never expected to have to respond to it, council workers who came in to do a completely different job, end up having to spend a lot of their time responding to, you know, something that is really, you know, hard and traumatic and difficult for everybody, and they're not equipped to be able to do it. But I really feel like we're falling on deaf ears with councils and the federal and state governments, because, you know, there just really isn't room for us. You know, housing will take a, you know, there's housing coming into places like Moreton Bay. The mayor there said they have 700 houses coming, but, you know, it takes, you know, 2 or 3 years for those houses to be built. So what do councils do in the meantime? And when we talk about housing too, we've got to really think about what is the most appropriate housing for people who are really, you know, at the real pointy end of homelessness, who have really complex needs. It's not just, you can't just put a person into a house and expect them to be okay. They need permanent supportive housing. And I know that the mayor of Moreton Bay was talking about that when they put this up. He said they've been asking for that for years. So I don't support I would not support a location that is, you know, sort of a camping location, but you have to think about the situation that they're in, and they've probably just run out of options.
Gregory, do you agree that councils are in a tough position?
Absolutely, I do. Yeah, absolutely. Look, from my perspective, these issues are community issues. You know, they begin in community, they need to end in community. But the role of government, whether that's local government, state government or Commonwealth government, is to support community in the resolution of these issues. Housing supply is a problem, but I think the response to this crisis is not just housing supply, it's about the way that we approach it. There are different ways to if we take the example of Byron Bay, Northern Rivers. Mm. Now, you know, a few years ago, 2019, this location had the highest rate of homelessness outside of Sydney in Australia. Okay, the council went away. It sought consultation, sought input, Developed some policies around that, committed to resolving the issue. In the last state rough sleeping count, that area was actually down quite significantly. I think it was about 13%, whereas the rest of the state was up 5%. So, it's not just about housing stocks, it's about the way that we consult, the way that we approach these issues. And it's getting community on board as well.
Well, if the text line's anything to go by, there's a lot of support in the community for more action on homelessness. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. With me is Dr. Gregory Smith, homelessness advocate and senior lecturer at Southern Cross University, and Leanne Mitchell from the Australian Alliance to End Homelessness, talking about one particular council that's designated a park as a safe place for homeless folks to camp out, and wondering what it looks like in your community. How are you noticing more people experiencing homelessness? Is your community responding in a particular kind of way? One says, I've noticed rough sleeping increasing dramatically over the decades. In my childhood, the 60s and 70s, I could always take people to a charity if I found them rough sleeping. People's Palace provided very basic accommodation cheaply. Now there's very little available. I'm ashamed to see how rough sleepers are treated. I note that the Rockhampton Council allows people to camp free in some parks. It's a stopgap, but it helps a lot, giving some security and dignity. Sally says, camping in winter, do they have to provide their own tents? Why not use empty government-owned properties for permanent housing? People with mental illness, trauma are the most vulnerable and sensitive to their surroundings. At least they wouldn't have the police moving them on. On the other hand, they're visible. Bullies who beat up on the homeless would know exactly where they are. A vexed question indeed. Well, Leanne, you've looked around Australia and internationally at this. What does best practice look like?
Well, as Dr. Gregory mentioned, Byron Bay is a really good example of best practice, and they are an advanced to zero community. There are more than 30 communities across Australia who are taking this an approach that looks at building collaborative systems, bringing in good outreach, getting to know every person who is experiencing homelessness in a community by name, and coordinating the efforts that they take to help that person with whatever they need to get into permanent supportive housing. And they build a by name list. That whole process is a really effective, proven way from around the world. And councils don't lead that work. They're part of a community-based effort to do that. So a council might provide do what they do well. Councils are good at bringing the community together. They're good at being able to, councillors can talk to the community and influence the way a community goes. So they're not the housing experts, but they're part of a collaborative effort. And we know that collaborative efforts are what we need to be able to do. And you have to realise that every single person's experience of homelessness is different. So we need to take really targeted ways of doing that. So there are more communities coming onto that. Maribyrnong here in Melbourne, where I am, was the newest community to come into Advanced to Zero about 2 weeks ago. So we are seeing great things. And the point about empty properties as well that your listener mentioned, for example, many years ago when I worked for the City of Melbourne, we had a situation where there was a growing number of people experiencing homelessness, and we pulled together a group from within the community to ask people what options are. And what came out of that was the fact that there was an aged care facility that was actually vacant at the time while they were waiting to redevelop a place, and we were able to, and a lot of people were able to jump in very quickly and convert that for a short amount of time and use that opportunity for people to sort of stay there on a temporary basis and be able to help them find places as they were moving in. I mean, nothing beats permanent housing. We have to remember that. But sometimes we've just got to find some opportunities in between. And there's a group called Meanwhile Use. They're looking at the reuse of buildings in the meanwhile, which is, I think, a great idea as well.
That's so interesting. So many different potential approaches to have. Gregory, from the community perspective, what's your message to people in communities about what their role is here?
Yeah, look, everybody in the community has a role to play here. I think the first step is about empathy, because a lot of these people, they're not homeless by choice. You know, when they were kids, they didn't dream about being vulnerable in situations where, you know, as Leah mentioned, bullies come and bash them and they keep getting moved on, et cetera. So having a little bit of empathy. You know, one of the big challenges we have is NIMBYism, not in my backyard. Mm. And that also creates some barriers for local government as well. But I think just developing an understanding. And I think if councils develop a homelessness policy and they're willing to share that with community, I think that helps to educate community. I think conversations like this are really important as well, because a young parent, young mum with two or three kids, she doesn't want to be vulnerable to these situations because her income doesn't allow her to afford reasonable accommodation.
Gregory, Leanne, thank you both so much for sharing your insights today. Gregory Smith, Dr. Gregory Smith, OAM, is homelessness advocate and professor at Southern Cross University. Leanne Mitchell is from the Australian Alliance to End Homelessness. And thank you as well for your texts. A lot of compassion on the text line. One says, congratulations to this community. Australia is starting to see the level of this crisis. Councils should be able to get federal government support to set these places up all over rural Australia. Another says, caravan parks are a good quick solution. You can set up immediately while homes are being built and vans can be moved around as required. People can donate vans after they finish their travels. Wagga has recently bulldozed tents in a caravan park. Mining camp setups might also be a good short-term solution for people without a home. However, another says, this strategy is normalising homelessness. Some countries have solved their homelessness problems by giving those people homes. Simple. Well, it's one that we'll definitely come back to here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up soon, when brands pretend to be your bestie, but first, the Gold Logie winner on the role of a lifetime, becoming a grandma. Well, it was the Logies last night. A previous Gold Logie winner has been speaking to me recently, though, talking about the role of a lifetime, becoming a nana, screen and stage actress, Home and Away mainstay, Lynn McGranger. She hasn't been a nana for long, but she's been hoping to land this role her whole life. I have been bringing you prominent Australians through the eyes of their grandchildren, part of our Life Matters special series, The Grandparent Trap, which you can go and find all of the installments of on ABC Listen. But for now, here's Lynn McGranger settling in to being a nana.
G'day, I'm Lynn McGranger. I'm an actress. I've been working on Australian television and in theatre for about, longer than I care to remember, 40 plus years. But I have recently become a grandmother to twin girls, non-identical, so basically two sisters born at the same time. And I have been a grandparent for 6 weeks. When I found out that my daughter was pregnant, I got a message from my daughter saying, we're coming around to talk to you about Newcastle. And when she said we, I thought, oh, that's odd, because Luke, her husband, only ever turns up when there's food involved. And I just had this feeling that they were going to tell us that they were pregnant. I don't know why, but I dismissed it because I thought, I don't want to be disappointed if they tell me that they've found a house in Maitland or whatever. I heard Luke's voice and he said, Lynn, what's this photo on the fridge in the kitchen? And I thought, oh, what's he going on about? So anyway, I went in there and there was this photo of the baby at a very early age. And there was two photos up there. And I thought, that's weird. And I went, oh, my God, you're pregnant. Why is there two photos? And I turned around and my daughter's holding up two fingers in with one hand and filming my reaction with the other, with the phone. And I may have said bullshit. And we were just so in disbelief. We could not believe it. And at the same time, we were just over the moon with delight and excitement. And we were just so happy and grateful. It was a wonderful moment in time and one I will never forget. Do you know, watching Clancy become a mum is probably the most wonderful thing. Oh, here I go again. Clancy is very, unlike me, she's very chilled, she's very sanguine. I think I've hardly ever seen her chuck a wobbly, whereas I'm the queen of wobblies. And watching her with those two babies is just one of the greatest gifts I could ever imagine. Clancy and Luke really are just wonderful parents, and it's heartwarming, and it just really makes me so happy watching them. What do I hope to teach the girls? I would like to teach them to be strong, although I suspect their mother will do that. I want to teach them to be themselves and to have faith in their own ability. I was one of those people as a child, and I still am to a degree, a people pleaser. And it just, you know, looking back on my life, is probably the one thing, if I could change, I would. But, you know, it's in my makeup. What are you going to do? I think if I could teach the girls to be kind, to be happy, to be accepting, but then not to be a walkover, to stand up for themselves, and I would teach them that family is everything, and that good lifelong friends are worth their weight in gold. To any of the grandparents out there, or the would-be grandparents out there, can I just say that whatever life has thrown your way to date, suddenly becoming a grandparent just is a whole new lease of life. Until it happens to you, you just can't conceive of it. And it is truly one of the most beautiful things on this God-given earth. I feel so blessed, and I'm the happiest woman alive at the moment.
Newly minted Nana Lynn McGranger talking about the joys of being a grandparent. It's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, when a brand wants to be your bestie. If your inbox is anything like mine, it's mostly filled with newsletters you'll never read and promotions from companies you haven't made a purchase from since, like, 2016. And a lot of the time, I admit, I delete them without a second glance. But anytime I do take a cursory skim, I've noticed a theme emerging. These brands are talking like they know me personally. They're like, hey, you left this in your cart. Or my personal unfavorite, Tegan, it's been a while. What's going on here? When did brands become so familiar? And does it make us more inclined to give them our money or our business? Well, you're about to hear from our resident consumer behavior expert, but I also want to hear from you. How do you feel about brands becoming cozy in the way they do customer service online? Does it make you cringe, or does it make you feel like you're talking to a real person? Here to unpack it all is Dr. Paul Harrison, Head of Consumer Behaviour at Deakin University. He joins me fortnightly for our Buyer Beware chat. Paul, it's been a while. Enter Life Matters 10 for 10% off at checkout. real person
or
pretending to be a real person? How do you feel when a brand gets cozy?
Because I know what's going on, I like you probably, I ignore it. Sometimes, I mean, I think one of the things we kind of know about human behavior is that when something is actually important to you, you do notice things, whether you're conscious of it or not. So these things work, but I think one of the mistakes that a lot of these businesses make is that because they have so much data and sending out emails particularly or sending out pop-ups and things is just so easy and fast and technologically simple, it's more of a kind of scattergun approach. And so we respond if we're actually in the space to buy the thing and we still want to buy it, but it's not as effective. And certainly I think many marketing companies put a lot of time and effort into trying to make this work, when in fact it's probably not the most efficient and effective way to get people to respond.
Why isn't it effective? I sort of thought it was probably a genius way of kind of playing on human nature.
Yeah, it's mostly not effective because it's not defined, it's not segmented. So a big part of this is actually trying to understand your customer. So it's a kind of a reverse process. What it's doing is it's saying, if we target everybody, if we go for a mass market approach, those people will self-select us. The problem is, and you kind of pointed this out in your opening, is that most of us ignore it. And so if every single brand, and then even within companies, if every single company kind of business unit within those companies is sending out some kind of reminder or something, it starts to just become something that we easily and quickly ignore. It's a little bit like, and this is, you know, the concept of selective perception, it's a little bit like early on, when you buy a car or you're thinking of buying a car, you always notice the car brand itself. But over time, you just stop noticing those things. And it's the same thing when it becomes just part of your environment, part of the kind of scape of everything you see, you have a different reaction. And that's the problem, is that these brands are trying to get your attention, and they're trying to get your attention in a really, you know, in particular ways. Depending on the approach and depending on the target market, we all will have different reactions. And I think, again, that's part of the complexity of this process. It's not as simple as creating a customer relationship management database. And, you know, there's lots of them around, like Salesforce and Adobe and all those things. Everyone loves them because it feels like, oh, I now know how to target my customers. But we as customers, we look at this and go, why am I getting four different emails or messages or something from the same company in a very short period of time?
So there's this sort of scattergun approach of slightly vanilla,
yeah,
you know, personal sort of thing. Sometimes it goes into like sassy territory though. Hmm. So there was an example recently where a TikTok influencer had some complaints about a lack of a gluten-free breakfast options at Sydney. Actually, I'm going to play you, this is a little bit of what she had to say.
Sydney Airport, you need to get your shit together, because I make this video like every 6 months, nothing happens. But tell me why I'm walking around to every single food place in the airport and no one does gluten-free. No one. Every single cafe, no gluten-free bread.
Okay, so that was sort of the opening shot from a human. Then Sydney Airport has kind of replied on, well, they, on their own TikTok account, they took the audio from that woman's TikTok and then just like had screenshots of all the gluten-free options at all of their restaurants, which, I mean, it was pretty funny. It's also kind of sassy, and it kind of goes against this idea of the customer's always right, Paul.
Yeah, there's a lot of attitude in there. And I think this is what people think kind of works in social media, is that there's a, you know, like if you create a brand personality, it's an effective way to get people to notice you. I think, again, the complexity here
I mean,
is that it will get...
about it.
Exactly. But it gets certain types of people to notice you, and people will have different responses. And I think that's the other thing, is that I think it's tricky, particularly a big brand like Sydney Airport has to always be a bit more cautious about these things. It could have a negative effect. The other thing too is, if you think about it, they probably don't need to do much at all, because once you're trapped in Sydney Airport, you really have to buy stuff anyway if you're hungry or whatever. So I think there's a lot more to it than just the social media. But I think some of the effects, and so there's the initial effects, which is people, you know, laugh at that and go, yeah, these gluten-free people, they need to get over themselves, blah, blah, blah. But then there's kind of, I guess, a secondary effect, which is, could be, that's funny and good on them for doing that. But then there might be an alternative customer that's going, that's arrogant.
And the thing we often don't realize, and you know, we're one of the secondary audiences, is that your customer isn't your only audience. It's everyone else who's watching that interaction. And I think, again, that then becomes part of that complexity, is that some people might find it cringy, some people might kind of find it, irreverent and things like that. But other people might say, why is Sydney Airport treating this person in this way? And it can get you into trouble. And I think, you know, particularly with one-way type media, which is pushing it out into the marketplace, you've always got to be careful about how all the different audiences are going to respond.
You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Dr. Paul Harrison for our fortnightly chat, Buyer Beware, all about consumer behaviour and also brand behaviour today. Brands trying to be cosy, brands trying to be sassy. You're telling me how you have seen this happening in the wild. One says, corporations are not our friends, but a lot of major ones like to project the whole easygoing Californian soft rock and cups of Java friendly vibe, especially in store when you're trying to buy, say, a new laptop. It's amazing how the smiles evaporate and the iciness creeps in from the very same staff when you go back with a significant problem a couple of months later. Another says, re-brands being your best friend. Thank God for the Spam Act 2003 is all I can say. Well, Paul, most of us in this conversation today are not brand managers. So the advice to them is sort of slightly moot. But as consumers, how do we navigate this landscape?
I think the first thing is, and I think we know this as consumers, is that, you know, there is a process, there's a click that goes in our head for most of us. Says, yeah, they're not our friend. They're not really our friend. I think there's a real interesting difference between, say, this way that people are using technology and digital technology, in that there's this desperate need for kind of, in inverted commas, authenticity. But I think we know that the underlying commercial objectives are there. I think one of the things that we should navigate is to step away from that and say, what's the point of this communication, if we read it, kind of thing. And we, as consumers, what we have to do is that we have to, first of all, then say the underlying principle is getting us to buy something. They're not our friend. This is not authentic. That's how we should respond to it as consumers. I think the issue is, for a lot of the companies themselves, they think that this is the thing that's going to have an effect, when in fact, and you know, that last person who sent a message to you, there was a kind of saying, it's when you interact with the human, that's actually when the experience is real. That's when it's authentic, and that's when you know whether this is true or not. And I think there's a lot of, we even as consumers, we place a lot of emphasis on the idea of how effective or not effective social media is. It's just part of the environment. And in reality, it's our experiences with other human beings that's actually more important, particularly in these types of interactions.
Always love interacting with fellow human beings. Paul Harrison, thank you so much, as always, for joining me.
Thanks, Tegan. Take care.
Dr. Paul Harrison, Head of Consumer Behaviour at Deakin University. I call our fortnightly chat Buyer Beware. I don't know why I need to call it that, though, because you guys are already so beware. One says on the text line, God save us from online merchants that address you like a stoned college buddy when things go wrong with an order. For example, sorry, it didn't work out, dude. There's nothing more we can do. They're stuck in 1993. You suddenly feel like what is a serious problem for you is a bit of a joke for them. It's Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Earlier in the show, we were talking about the idea of paying with a smile, facial recognition payment rather than tapping a phone or a card or a smartwatch. It's a technology that is coming to Australia. And I asked what you thought about this, whether you would use it. Well, here is what Kirsten Drysdale, independent journalist and host of the Internet Reviewed, had to say about whether she thought this tech would actually take off.
I'm skeptical that it'll catch on in the same way as the phone and the watch. But then again, I do also see how easily persuaded we are by convenience and small treats. So I saw that one of the announcements for this technology to be used in, say, cafes and things is that it'll be a way to track your loyalty points. So, you know, ultimately, is that enough of a carrot for us to give into this? You know, a free coffee once a fortnight. In return for scanning my face to pay. I personally feel like it won't be adopted the same way as the phone or the watch, but I might be wrong about that.
That's Kirsten Drysdale chatting to me earlier in the show. I do recommend going back and listening to that full chat if you have a chance. You just have to search for Life Matters on ABC Listen to find that. Well, that is just about it for Life Matters. I've come to you from Palawa land today. I'll be back with you again tomorrow. We're going to talk about the post-chemo void. Maybe you thought the hard part was over, the intensity of active cancer treatment. But some people say the phase where chemotherapy ends can leave them feeling a bit adrift. Plus, no, I can't afford that. I can't come along. The power of loud budgeting, telling people when you can't afford stuff in an effort to save money. That's tomorrow on Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.